and welcome to Week in Review, your weekly roundup of news and analysis from OnBiff around the world. I'm Julie Leviat-Bignoli. Today, we're talking about negative interest rates, Chinese banks' global outreach, and decadent Brexit. All that and more coming right up. And welcome to this edition of Week in Review. As followers of OnBiff will know, the COVID-19 crisis has prompted central banks to respond with extraordinary measures to try and rescue the world's economies. In the case of the Bank of England, the next step might be to introduce negative interest rates. But these, wrote Denai Kyriakopoulou, should be a last resort. Denai wrote, "Evidence around the effectiveness of negative rates is weak. Only a few central banks have implemented them. In most cases, negative rates were introduced alongside other accommodative measures, such as quantitative easing or yield curve control, making it difficult to disentangle and estimate the individual net effects. The underlying theory behind negative rates is to disincentivize banks from depositing money at the central bank. This is intended to boost lending to businesses and households, discourage saving, and encourage spending in order to increase aggregate demand and raise GDP growth. Whether they work in practice ultimately depends on the transmission mechanism, whether the direct impact on banks trickles down to their clients. In today's high-pressure macroeconomic environment, with businesses and households already under strain, it may be politically difficult for banks to pass on the costs of negative rates to depositors. Even if the policy is successful in boosting aggregate demand, this may alleviate some pressure, but will not be a game-changer in an economy that primarily faces a supply-side shock, as is the case now. What is needed instead is targeted fiscal support." But the bigger risk with negative rates is not that they don't bring the desired benefits. It is that they bring more harm than good. After a certain point, what economists call the reversal rate, rate cuts hurt savers more than they help borrowers, and so lower spending and investment rather than boost it. It is difficult to be certain of when this point is reached, but the further down rates go, the more material the risk is. The Bank of England has already cut rates twice this year to almost zero. To avoid financial stability risks, the policy would be best timed when targeted supply-side measures are already in place to ease the cost of financing such projects. Communication with the markets is key. If rate cuts are already priced in, the actual move may have little effect. The Bank of England would need to get its forward guidance right. Ultimately, the bank is guided by its inflation mandate. The present crisis is creating both upward and downward pressures on inflation, but overall long-term shifts point to structurally lower inflation. In the end, it may be the target, not the instruments, that the bank needs to start looking at more closely. Last week, OnBiff economist Chris Papadopoulos wrote about past and future trends in cross-border banking. This inspired regular contributor Herbert Ponish to write about Chinese banks and their cross-border activities. Herbert wrote, "The footprints of large Chinese banks are all over the world, propelled by China's economic clout and the Belt and Road Initiative. In addition to cross-border lending, they have set up branches and subsidiaries abroad. Some have bought minority stakes in local banks, including ICBC Standard Bank in Africa, or fully acquired them. The major banks have more than 500 affiliates each. These affiliates' cross-border lending is as substantial as that of their parent banks. Chinese banks in Hong Kong account for around one-third of China's total annual $1.6 trillion cross-border lending. The absolute amounts of their overseas business are significant, but they represent only a small part of their overall business, which is firmly anchored in China. Per the latest Bank for International Settlements locational banking statistics, according to nationality, Chinese banks, including the policy banks, have overseas assets of $2.2 trillion and overseas liabilities of $2 trillion. This would make Chinese banks' overseas business comparable to that of German banks." According to the Bank Internationalization Index, Calculated annually by the Academy for Internet Finance, Chinese banks' overseas business accounts for less than one-third of their total business, compared with two-thirds for other countries' largest global banks. What kind of business should be included under global activity? There are the cross-border claims and liabilities from China and of their overseas affiliates, funded from the head office and locally, as they act like local banks. Half of their lending is to banks and the rest to non-banks. Lending to foreign banks could be through various regional interbank associations. Lending under the BRI can be directly to foreign entities, but is mostly to domestic firms to undertake these projects. The debtors would be BRI countries, but do not appear as claims on Chinese banks' balance sheets. The final question should be how much global risk Chinese banks are taking on by lending through various channels. While this information is available to the China Banking and Insurance Regulatory Commission, foreign analysts rely on estimates. Given their solid foundation in China and the implicit guarantee by the Chinese government, they are too big to fail and thus are likely to continue their global outreach, even if some borrowers, ranging from prominent Western customers to BRI countries, cannot meet their obligations. With all the focus on coronavirus, it's been a while since we mentioned Brexit. The negotiations are still plodding along, though, virtually. John Orchard and Ellie Groves wrote, "Boris Johnson's room for manoeuvre is as much constrained by COVID-19 as it is enhanced by it. Nobody Omviv spoke to discounted the chance of a last-minute deal or a set of mini-deals, with Johnson able to pass off concessions and even money to the EU under the banner of getting a deal done in time when all had dismissed the chances of just that. Plenty is stacked against this outcome." The view some months ago was that ardent Brexiteer Johnson would be more likely than predecessor Theresa May, as a reluctant convert, to bring a softer Brexit under the guise, "Any deal is a win for Brexiteers." But due to COVID-19 and his personal experience of the health crisis, Johnson is operating under a different environment. Despite his parliamentary majority, Johnson still needs to appease the conservative right wing who have pushed him to loosen lockdown. There is a debate among Brexiteers about whether the crisis presents an opportunity to usher through the short-term inconveniences of no deal, an idea described to Omviv as a decadent Brexit. There is some excitement among backbenchers, according to a long-standing Eurosceptic, about the freedom to press ahead with a US trade deal which would be constrained by level playing field standards. The last round of UK-EU talks concluded with David Frost, the UK negotiator, accusing the EU of dogmatism and his counterparty, Michel Barnier, countering with an enumeration of the UK's liking to have its cake and eat it. COVID-19 had indeed intruded. The negotiators themselves were ill. Meetings have been hampered by the video format, which precludes corridor conversations, and the crisis has changed priorities both for politicians and civil servants. Plenty remains unchanged by COVID. The two sides are losing interest in one another. "Only 10 minutes on Brexit, please," was the instruction for the June Council of Ministers meeting, we are told. A French official we talked to seemed relaxed. His government expects the UK to land on a no-deal Brexit and then, after finding it a nuisance in places, gradually to work its way back to a less advantageous arrangement than the status quo ante. This may wear thin for both sides as the December deadline approaches and the political realities around disgruntled French fishermen and shambolic customs procedures at Dover and between Great Britain and its regulatory co-dominion with the EU in Northern Ireland sink in. There are meaty contingencies in the financial markets still to be settled. A bridging arrangement to enable euro derivatives to be cleared through London runs out in December. Avowals to settle equivalents in a non-political way by June were empty. It is unclear which side will be damaged most if these are not addressed. So addressed, presumably, they will be. This week, we released part 3 of our COVID response series with EY. In this edition, David Marsh speaks to Simon Woods, EY's global response leader for the COVID-19 repercussions on the insurance industry. They discuss the pandemic's effect on the global insurance industry, including the immediate and longer-term consequences for operations and technology, looking at the challenges and opportunities brought by digitalization. They examine the financial health of the insurance sector as a result of the volatility in financial markets and the recession. They also provide pointers on how the insurance industry can work with customers, governments, and regulators in contributing to economic recovery and societal good. And they investigate the outlook for innovation, new methods of winning and serving customers, and worldwide insurance consolidation. You can listen to the recording of their conversation or read the transcript on omfif.org. David also sat down with Didier Borowski, head of Global Views at French asset manager Amundi, to talk about the options facing the ECB after the ruling on bond purchases by the German Constitutional Court. Didier expects the ECB at the next monetary policy meeting on the 4th of June to increase its pandemic emergency bond buying programme by 400 to 500 billion euros. Both the recording and transcript of their discussion are available on the website. Moving on to our virtual meetings now, on Wednesday the 3rd of June, we are hosting a roundtable on the impact of monetary and fiscal policies on investment markets. Also on Wednesday, we have a virtual panel on economic and financial trends in Latin America. On Thursday the 4th of June, Verena Ross, Executive Director of the European Securities and Markets Authority, outlines the actions ESMA is taking to monitor market developments, maintain orderly markets, and ensure effective supervision. And finally, also on Thursday, join us for a panel on the prospects for sovereign debt restructuring and access to financing across Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. And that is all for this edition of Week in Review. To read more about everything we've discussed, visit omfif.org or scroll down to the notes underneath this podcast, where you will find links to everything mentioned today. If you wish to stay up to date with OMFIF news, analysis, and forthcoming meetings, sign up at omfif.org/subscribe. I'm Julie Levy-Vignoli. Thank you for listening.